You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Wisconsin candidates for U.S. Senator are set to debate tomorrow night, and you can hear it all live here on WPR. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association debate starts at 7 tomorrow, and you can listen to an hour of debate plus analysis after it wraps, all here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. Now, pay transparency laws have been cropping up across the country. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed one into law just last week, requiring companies with more than 15 employees to post salary ranges and job listings. Colorado's had its own transparency law since last year, and New York City has one that takes effect next month. So what does this mean for workers and employers? And should there be more pay transparency here in Wisconsin? Our next guest studies some of those questions. She says when you look closely at the effects of these laws, results aren't always what you'd expect. So I invite you to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think salary ranges should be posted on job listings? Would that help your bargaining power as a worker? And if you're an employer, what would pay transparency mean for you? You want to see more transparency around wages required in Wisconsin? Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Zoe Collins is an assistant professor at the Harvard Business School who researches pay transparency. And Zoe, thanks for joining us today.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
And as you look at it through your study and research, what's driving the trend in pay transparency laws these days?
Well, it does seem to be gaining traction. I agree with you, but I don't think it's new to the U.S. So, in fact, there have been episodes in history, namely the earliest being 1918 that I know of, when there was a brief period and everybody's salaries were posted publicly in a newspaper for a brief period of time. So I don't know that this is totally new, but it definitely feels exciting and like it's gaining momentum.
Yeah, and there are a lot of different versions of these laws, but Zoe, if you could explain in general how they should work.
So, typically the way people think about transparency is from the perspective of someone who's underpaid. And if we had a mandate enabling them to see what their coworkers are being paid, they'd suddenly realize that they're being paid less than their equals. And then they could use that information, bring it to their employer, and ask for a raise. So I think that's the intention of the policy, is to sort of close pay gaps between people who are doing similar work.
But as you have done your research, it turns out, as I understand it, that in general, people would be willing to pay a couple weeks of their salary in order to keep from everybody else knowing what that salary is.
That's right. So one question is, why do we even need these laws in the first place if you can just talk to your coworker? Yeah, that's totally the case. And so, you know, the question is, why don't those conversations happen? And what we find in our research is that people's demand to know this information is quite high, but equally strong is their demand to keep their own information private.
That makes some sense there. Zoe Cullen joining us, assistant professor at the Harvard Business School, taking a look at pay transparency. And through your research, do we know now how, or are we beginning to learn how pay transparency can affect employers?
Well, that's a great question, because yes, indeed, I think that's the case. But most of our research is actually based on transparency laws that are focused on revealing salaries internal to a company. So this is when firms are asked to let workers talk to each other, post anonymous spreadsheets using Google Docs, whatever it is. And now we're looking at a series of laws that actually publicize salaries in the job advertisement itself, meaning that not only will you learn more about what your employer is paying your coworkers, you'll also have access to information about what people are being paid who are doing similar work in other firms. And on the other side, the employers themselves also have more information about what their competitors are paying. And from this new set of policies, we have to sort of pick different pieces of evidence from our past evaluations and decide what's going to be most applicable. And so I can launch into my speculation, but of course, this is all based on studies that have been done on different types of pay transparency policies.
So what would your speculation be at this point? What are you thinking?
I think the closest closest form of pay transparency that speaks to this is actually work that I've done with my co-author on what happens when an employer sees the wages of other firms.
Oh.
And this is true when salary benchmarking is more widely accessible. And the context we study is when firms gain access to real-time data through a payroll provider of the wages for people in the position that they're hiring for, but across the industry. And what we find there is that employers see this information, it's news to them, which is point one. Point two is they tend to then move their wages towards the median of that distribution. And so this means that workers end up being paid more equally who are doing similar work across firms. There's sort of convergence of salaries towards the median pay. And then on top of that, we do see boosts in salary levels. And this is accompanied by increased retention that firms experience and also higher vacancy fill rates.
Zoe Cullen, from the perspective of a job seeker, I would think that pay transparency would be very useful. It seems like something that people looking for a job would care a lot about. How do we know how pay transparency affects job seekers?
I'm so glad you asked that. So the best research we have on that is actually in the context of Germany. And it's my colleague, Simon Jaeger, Nina Rassil, Chris Roth, who have done work in asking workers, what do you know about your outside options, what you would get if you asked a different firm to have a job. And these are for workers who are currently employed, so they're not necessarily searching. And what they find is that those workers who are typically at the lower end of the earnings distribution in a firm, they tend to underestimate what they would get if they were to try to switch jobs. So from their work, we can take a leap and say, well, if jobs were more explicit about what they would pay, and these were posted widely on job advertising boards, then people who are lesser paid today would raise their expectations of what they could get if they switched jobs. So that's what we would expect to see, potentially more movement among those who are underpaid.
What about the emotional impact of pay transparency? What you know as an employee, how all the other employees are faring in terms of wages, and you compare yourself to them. What have you found in terms of emotional outcomes or well-being?
Yes. So this is a complex question, but we have a lot of evidence on this. So pay transparency, as discussed and as we've been discussing, often focuses on what somebody learns or feels when they discover information directly about a peer, so someone in the same position, title, same location. And we know from that setting that people who find out they're paying less than they thought relative to their peers experience low morale, and this translates into lower effort, lower productivity. We can't rule out that people who discover they're being paid more than they thought don't have a symmetric positive boost. So it could be that this goes both ways. The piece that people forget is that most pay transparency policies also end up revealing quite a bit about what your seniors earn and what you might earn if you got promoted or say you got a different position that's more lucrative in another firm. And that tends to be very motivating and raise morale among employees.
So pay transparency for executives or people who are above you in the corporate structure might be an incentive for you to work a little harder towards that next raise?
That's actually, so overall, when we look at these morale responses, because people are most surprised about what their seniors earn and what they could get when they're promoted, it kind of swamps these negative morale effects we've seen when peers compare each other to themselves.
Very interesting. Zoe Cullen, our guest, assistant professor at the Harvard Business School, who researches pay transparency with pay transparency laws taking effect here in New York City, and it's going to take effect in California at the beginning of next year, just signed into law by Governor Newsom last week. What do you think about pay transparency? Would you like to see it in Wisconsin? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Michael in Appleton now. Michael, you're on the air with Zoe Cullen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I would normally say Rob, but I'm calling for, so I wanted to just say, as somebody who has recently spent a fair amount of time looking on the job market, Something like this in Wisconsin would be a huge time saver for so many people. It's incredibly frustrating, to sink time into filling out an application, potentially interviewing for a job that, it turns out is not going to pay enough to make a living. The other thing I just wanted to bring up, not that it's the same, but just related, one thing I've noticed a lot of employers will do is they have policies or communications or what have you, trying to dissuade their workers from discussing salary with other employees. And I just wanted to make the point that that is something that is protected on a federal level under the NLRA and NLRB.
Michael, thank you for pointing that out, and thank you for sharing your experience out there in the job market. And, at least recently, we've heard that the job market's been pretty good out there for those who are looking for work. But at the same time, if you don't know what that work's going to pay, what good is it for you, Zoe?
Yes, I completely agree. I completely agree with this. So Michael brought up an important point, which is, technically, many of us are protected in discussing with our coworkers salaries. And that law has been in place since 1935. Now, it's been called a toothless tiger because if an employer were to retaliate against you, it's not clear they would face any punishments, except in specific states that have started to really strengthen this law and put in additional penalties. And so I would say that despite the existence of this law, some of these pay transparency policies are very likely to shift beliefs about the pay of others because even in spite of these laws, there's been so little discussion and there has been sort of a veil of secrecy. So I'm excited to see how it will help you weed out the jobs that are appropriate and the jobs that might be less so.
Michael, thank you for the call. We're talking to Zoe Cullen. She's an assistant professor at the Harvard Business School, and she's with us to talk about pay transparency laws, how they work, and some of their potential unexpected consequences. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We know about the pay gaps. We know that they exist. But we don't know how big that gap can be. Should we? 1-800-642-1234. We continue our conversation and perhaps hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Zoe Cullen from the Harvard Business School about pay transparency laws and what they could mean here in Wisconsin and for you. And we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Zoe, so one of the main reasons given for transparency is reducing the pay disparities that we know about among women and people of color. But do these pay transparency laws succeed in that?
By and large, the answer is yes.
Oh.
Yes. So it's true that many of these policies, in fact, all the ones that I've considered and the ones that I've reviewed from others, have had the tendency to close gender gaps. And oftentimes we don't get to explicitly see ethnicities, but we would expect that, in fact, any of the groups that are typically at the lower end of the distribution would experience gains relative to the people at the upper end.
Interesting. Let's go to Nels in Viroqua next. Nels, you're on the air with Zoe Cullen.
Yeah, good discussion. Discussion that several of us have been thinking about for several decades now. It's a crime that this hasn't happened already, but both from a employee standpoint and also from a manager standpoint, makes it a lot easier to manage when you know what you're dealing with. Here's the problem. And you can talk all you want about peer, relative pay amongst peers. But the thing that really matters is not the peer-to-peer so much as, that's where a lot of games and a lot of resentments and a lot of problems occur in managing your people. But the real problem that we've got is that the upper management, the senior executive class, their pay, even if you had a pay transparency law put into place as posed, it's not really going to get to the heart of the problem because a lot of their pay is non-monetary remuneration, right? They're getting stock options, they're getting all kinds of other benefits that can't be and aren't on the books precisely so they aren't on the books.
Nels, I appreciate that perspective. And overall compensation for some of these executives, do pay transparency laws include some of the deferred compensation that may be included in there? And if not, what are we missing out when it comes to executive pay, Zoe Cullen?
You know, this totally true that a fair amount of compensation for the very, very top earners might not be included in the types of base pays that are being reported. Now, the SEC does require that many of those forms of remuneration that were listed are included. So for CEOs, for example, we've seen laws that have been in place for decades now that do require full disclosure. But in general, absolutely, it's going to be hard to think about how these salary range policies, for example, are going to say much about what a COO or a CTO is really earning. That said, stock options and equity, that we're talking now about a very small percentage, I believe 2% of compensation in the U.S. So, in fact, it might not be affecting the salaries of the people who generally these policies are intended to influence.
Zoe, we're seeing an increased number of gig economy workers, and I'm wondering whether or not pay transparency would have any impact on them.
Well, to the extent that they are also looking at these job boards, considering their alternatives, yes.
Okay, sure. Do we know how remote work is generally being treated under pay transparency laws?
Well, we've seen some interesting examples where employers who are okay with remote work have decided that they were going to avoid salary range posting laws in any particular state. So to that extent, there's sort of some spillovers between the location of the job and exactly which law applies to that employer. However, I'm not sure this is going to matter, as California and New York are so large that it's hard to imagine that employers who are operating in either of them are going to try to avoid posting in those states.
But haven't we seen stories with Colorado's pay transparency laws where employers have avoided that?
That's right. So Colorado might have been in a slightly different position than California and New York, or that's my go-to intuition.
Zoe, I want to ask about the unintended consequences of pay transparency laws. What has not been considered that you have found in your research?
Well, so one thing I've described to you that I haven't gone into detail about is exactly how this gender gap is closed. Because we've considered this from the perspective of an underpaid worker asking their employer for a raise. And we haven't yet talked about what happens when we think about the employer's perspective, what they decide to do when they know that raising the wage of one worker means they might have to raise the wage of everyone else. Mm. So to walk you through this, if that's the case, that an employer recognizes that a salary increase for one person means costs across the board, it's going to make the employer much more incentivized to bargain aggressively. And the optimal wage setting for that employer is now to set a lower average wage for everyone. And that's been something we have seen happen. It looks like it's the case when the U.S. rolled out state-by-state laws that increased protections for coworkers to talk to each other about pay. We saw the wave of Google spreadsheets that anonymized and shared salary information. And then on the tail of that, we saw a decline in the salaries, the average salaries.
Is there a role that organized labor plays in these pay transparency laws? Is there something different for unions?
So what I described to you is actually a setup where each person is bargaining themselves. So one person asks for a raise, and if they get that raise, then the employer has to renegotiate with everyone else. But in the context of a unionized workforce, people are bargaining collectively. And so that type of spillover looks very different. So when we look at occupations with high rates of unionization, transparency does not, in fact, affect the average wage levels.
And just to reiterate here, your research, Zoe, says that one of the potential unintended consequences here, it could generally lower wages across the board as businesses are concerned about having to raise wages for everybody if they do so.
That's true. You captured what I was saying exactly, except that I want to highlight those policies we've been studying in the past, the ones that have been very popular here in the U.S., have really focused on internal transparency. These are cases where the employer now faces spillovers between the negotiations with workers they've already hired and new workers for their firm. And now we're looking at potentially a different set of competitive effects where work for employees who are now looking at firms that are posting wages outside of their own employer are going to be negotiating with a different employer. And the same spillovers are considered quite distinct. Now that other employer can raise the wage for this new hire from a different firm and not worry about those people who had been, you know, the other employees at that original firm.
And finally, Zoe, with about a minute we have left, who tends to support or push for new pay transparency laws? Is there momentum for it on a wider scale?
I think there is. Surprisingly, but given the counterintuitive results I just described to you, it is still the case that employers seem hesitant to adopt pay transparency laws and employees seem to advocate for it. Now, I don't think that's the full story. I think we're hearing from a very small number of voices on the employer side, at least. So it's not entirely clear to me that employers are not going to be supportive of these pay transparency laws. But I do think that the advocates are coming from, generally speaking, equity concerns and employees who are building on the wave for greater equity in the workplace and in other parts of society.
And what are you looking at next? What's the big question you want to answer that's on the horizon, Zoe Cullen?
Well, I'm really curious about this directed search piece. Are people directing their applications towards employers who are higher paying employers because they know something about what those employers are paying?
Zoe Cullen, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Zoe Cullen, she's an assistant professor at the Harvard Business School with us today to talk about pay transparency laws that have been popping up across the country and some of the unexpected downsides and upsides that can come with them. Her research continues, and your input is always valuable. So if you've got more to say on the pay transparency and what it could mean or do in the state of Wisconsin, you can always email us ideas@WPR.org. We're always up on the Facebook page where we asked you about it earlier today, and you can still chime in. Would be interested in knowing what you think now that we've addressed some of the direct consequences and some of the unintended consequences, ideas@WPR.org, or check us out on Facebook. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, the future of forensic investigations. Meet the UW-Platteville students using soil samples and drone imaging to document graves located unmarked sites containing remains. And tomorrow, you'll also meet the founder of Climate Alpha, an expert climate migration tracker who reveals where people will be moving in the coming decades as climate change intensifies and what we need to be tracking here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show from 7 to 9 here on the Ideas Network. Fat Bear Week has finally arrived, and voting began yesterday for your favorite brown bear in Alaska's Katmai National Park. A dozen of the park's biggest bears are competing to be this year's fan favorite. Last year's winner and four-time champion Otis is back again, but he's facing some stiff competition from younger bears, including the winner of this year's Fat Bear Junior spinoff competition, who just learned to catch fish for herself this summer. Or there's 747, a bear with a tag number that fits so well, weighing up to 1,400 pounds, this big boy needs no other name. Eat up, because the fatter the better for the coming winter hibernation. No, not you. You need to vote early. And vote often for your favorite honky-chonk bear donk-a-donk. The link to vote and learn more is on our website, WPR.org/Central Time. Then stay tuned for Fat Bear Tuesday next week, when this year's winner will be named and WPR's biggest big bear fan, Rob Ferret, celebrates here on Central Time. I'm just your Cub reporter, Lee Rayburn, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Rob Ferret. Wisconsin candidates for U.S. Senator are set to debate tomorrow night, and you can hear it live right here. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association debate starts at 7. Listen to an hour of debate plus analysis after it wraps right here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. Now, if you've ever wondered about why an apple doesn't fall through your kitchen table, or you fall through the crust of the earth, or the amount of momentum needed to throw a ball, then you've thought about physics. It's everywhere. In fact, you can't escape it. People have tried, whether we think about it or not. And while it can be challenging for me to wrap my head around it, one scientist writes that physics can be approachable and even a dinner table conversation. So, Join us for the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What do you find most interesting about our real world? We talked about quantum physics yesterday and the Nobel Prize for quantum physics. It seems to change everything you thought about physics, at least at the smallest level. So what do you want to know about our real world and how real it can be? 1-800-642-1234. Our guest, Sean Carroll, professor of natural philosophy at Johns Hopkins University. He's written multiple books on cosmology and physics, and most recently, The Biggest Ideas in the Universe, Space, Time, and Motion, the first in a trilogy. Sean, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's start with the biggest thing I can think of, Sean, and that would be infinity. What could be possibly bigger than that? But then as you write in your book, and I'm like, all right, I got you, Sean. And then you write, well, we shouldn't confuse what we can hold in our head with what nature actually does. Are you telling me that nature doesn't do infinity?
I'm telling you that we don't know. I mean, infinity is something where we can talk about it. We often, as mathematicians, as scientists, philosophers, we discuss what properties infinity should have, but we don't actually know for sure whether or not infinity exists in the universe. So I'm I try to be very cautious about those things that we can say with confidence and those things we're a little bit up in the air about.
Well, something to think about infinity, the number of numbers between 0 and 1 would be the same size of numbers between from negative infinity all the way to infinity. Well, wrap your head around that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And this is a crucial fact when we try to understand infinity. This was a brilliant contribution by Georg Cantor, who's a mathematician over 100 years ago, where he realized that there's different sizes of infinity. You're exactly right. The number of numbers between 0 and 1 is the same as the number of numbers between minus infinity and plus infinity, but it's bigger than the number of integers, 0, 1, 2, 3, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3. So there's different levels when it comes to infinity.
Sean, as you begin to approach physics, how do you begin to approach people about physics? It can be a little daunting, I would imagine.
It's absolutely daunting. Look, it's daunting for me, and I've been doing it for many, many years. I'm daunted every day. But that's okay. You know, it's our universe. We all share this universe that we live in, and most of us are very curious about it. I think it's kind of a shame that curiosity gets pushed down and beaten out of us in some ways by our schooling and the demands of earning a living and things like that. So I want to rekindle that curiosity for the people who have put it aside and feed it for those for whom it's still a big motivation.
And as you wrote about in your introduction, you want to have these conversations with people. You want to have these debates about what really is real out there.
Yeah, I think, again, we do live in the universe. We're curious about it. And that means that we have opinions about it. You know, we think that certain things sound reasonable to us. Certain things sound unreasonable. And when new evidence comes in, new experiments come in, we're always kind of really thrilled to see what we've learned about the universe.
Our guest is the author of The Biggest Ideas in the Universe. And you break down the first book in your upcoming trilogy, Sean, into Space, Time, and Motion. And let's start with space, because my initial thought is space by definition is empty. But as you write, it's filled with information.
Well, space is where we live. You know, physicists think about space maybe in a slightly different way than people do. It's not just outer space. It's really just the set of all possible locations that you can imagine. So you have a location in space. The Earth has a location in space. Some parts of space are empty, but some parts are full of stuff. You know, the center of the Earth is a location in space. We're still, one of the fun things about a book like this is I can admit all of the stuff we still don't understand.
So well, that's refreshing.
We're not trying to pretend to know more than we do, even though we know a lot. There's a long-running debate that I talk about that goes back to Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz about, is space a thing all by itself, or is it just a way of talking about the locations and distances between other things? And honestly, we don't know, still to this day.
If we don't know that, I mean, what else can we not know? What else can we possibly know? But as you're talking about space and how you define it in terms of relationships with other things, I'm thinking about time and how it defines us as relationships in space.
I hope you will not be disappointed if we don't fully understand what time is at the most fundamental level either. But I have to emphasize here, you know, there's a difference between understanding something completely and understanding it at all. Like, I don't understand the car I drive completely, right? There's parts of the engine which, if they break, then I'm out of luck. I need to call in an expert. But I can drive it, and I understand a lot about it. And I think that space and time are like that, too. We actually understand a lot about them through the progress that's been made by hundreds of years of physics. So to say that we don't understand everything is not to despair. There's quite a bit that we know.
Like how it operates, like how we operate through it, space and time. But it's Einstein that puts them together, doesn't he? Or it's Einstein and a bunch of scientists around that time that begin to understand these might be inextricably linked.
Yeah, it's a funny story, actually. You know, space and time have been with us a long time, and Isaac Newton gave us a way of thinking about them in which they're both real, but they're completely distinct. You wouldn't mix them up. In 1905, Einstein puts together what we now call the special theory of relativity, and it's 2 years later that his old math professor, Hermann Minkowski, says, you know, Albert, there's a way of thinking about your theory, which is as a unification of space and time into space-time. And Einstein's reaction was, you know, that sounds like, you know, mathematical flummery. It's a little bit, you know, too abstract for me. I'm more down to earth. And it took him a couple of years, but he caught on that actually this space-time conception was the best way of thinking about it.
And this brings us to the final portion of your first book in this trilogy, The Biggest Ideas of the Universe, and that's motion. Because with the space-time continuum now, or these two linked up, we begin to understand motion a little bit better in terms of action at a distance, which it was Newton who said that's an absurdity. I believe no one who has a competent faculty of thinking can ever fall into it. But he was just talking about gravity, wasn't he? Action at a distance, gravity.
He was, and this is important if anyone was listening yesterday when you were talking about the new Nobel Prize and quantum mechanical action at a distance. The idea of action at a distance being troublesome and puzzling goes way back further than quantum mechanics. It goes to Isaac Newton, where he proposed this formula for the force of gravity, that gravity pulls things together, but it fades away as you get further and further away. And so the question arises, what's doing the pulling? What is the thing, the mechanism, the substance that carries the force of gravity? And in Newton's theory, it was nothing. It just happened. And that was the sort of troublesome aspect of the action at a distance. And that actually is something that we have come to understand through the work of people like Pierre-Simon Laplace in France and Einstein himself, that there's a field that pervades the space and time in between the stars and the planets that carries the force of gravity. And then separately, when quantum mechanics comes along, there's a new kind of action at a distance, which Einstein called spooky action at a distance. Yes. And so we're still struggling with that one. I have my ideas. Other people have their ideas. But we're not settled down with that one yet.
Sean Carroll, our guest, professor of natural philosophy at Johns Hopkins University and the author of The Biggest Ideas of the Universe. And as we talk about motion taking place across time, I have to wonder whether or not time can go in the other direction. And you do write about time reversal in your book, Sean. Tell us about it. How does that work?
We talk about time reversal as purely a thought experiment kind of thing. You know, we say if we take some stuff, some experimental system or whatever, and we let it evolve over time, and then we take exactly the same stuff, but we sort of point it in the other direction and let it evolve backwards. So if you throw a ball in one direction, it lands somewhere, but then you throw it backwards. So essentially, you're doing the same kind of experiment, but in a reversed direction of time. And there's a lot of subtleties there, and I won't go into all of them, but the upshot is that the laws of physics, as we best understand them, are reversible. Whatever you do, you can undo at the fundamental level. It doesn't seem that way in our macroscopic world. You can break an egg, but not unbreak it.
Right.
But the deep down laws of physics that are underlying everything that happens work equally well forward or backward in time.
which bring us to white holes, not the black holes, the white ones. And we'll continue our conversation and invite you to participate as well as we talk about the biggest ideas in the universe, a deeper understanding of our space, time, and motion with our guest, Sean Carroll, professor of natural philosophy at Johns Hopkins University. And if you have questions about our physical real universe or the quantum level, as we talked about yesterday, 1-800-642-1234 to join us. And we'll continue the conversation next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we've been going back in time with our guest, Sean Carroll, author of the book, The Biggest Ideas in the Universe, Space, Time, and Motion. He's joining us to talk about our physical reality and how we can make it a little more fun. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. And where we left off was talking about going back in time to study white holes and how this leads us to the absolute start of our universe as we perhaps know it, the Big Bang Theory. Sean, what are white holes?
Well, a white hole is exactly a black hole played backward in time, which sounds a little weird because why are you playing black holes forward in time in the first place? But the idea of a black hole does have a directionality of time built into it because it's a region of space-time with the property that once you enter, you can't leave. And of course, we mean going forward in time, you can't leave, right? So it's a one-way kind of trap. So a white hole, is a region of space-time that you can leave, but if you do, you can never go back. Sort of it expels you in some way. And just like a real black hole has the property that if you go in, you will eventually crunch into a singularity of infinite density, in a white hole, everything comes out of a singularity of infinite density. And that's very much like, at least analogous to, what happens in our real universe in the Big Bang.
But Sean Carroll, we started the conversation with my supposition that the biggest ideas in the universe was infinity. You can't get bigger than that. And then you said that just might be in your mind, man. So now we have this infinite density that it is the Big Bang that is the start of our universe as we know it, this singularity.
Yeah, and that bugs us. The very word singularity is supposed to indicate to you that something is going wrong. So this is a feature of Einstein's theory of general relativity that, you know, he wrote down an equation in 1915, and we're still learning about the implications of that equation. So it was Roger Penrose and Stephen Hawking and others who in the 1960s proved that under very wide ranges of circumstances, general relativity would predict the existence of singularities, places where the curvature of space-time would become infinite. Mm. And people are worried about that. And I think that the correct attitude to take toward it is that probably means general relativity is wrong in those circumstances. And that's okay. That's actually not as terrible as it sounds because general relativity is incompatible with quantum mechanics, which is another important part of physics. So we will someday need a better theory that includes general relativity but is compatible with quantum mechanics. And maybe in that theory, the singularities will go away.
Sean Carroll, professor of natural philosophy at Johns Hopkins University, author of The Biggest Ideas in the Universe, Space, Time, and Motion, and your opportunity to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234, where Jeff in Superior is standing by. Jeff, what are your big ideas?
Is it possible there's no such thing as a straight line? Because if everything's vibration, you'd have to stop time. And even then, you can't imagine a straight line because it's moving.
Oh, Jeff, I think, Sean, you get into this a little bit in your book, if not a lot.
You know, it always depends on what you mean by a straight line. And I hate it that it's true that so many of my answers are going to begin with, it depends on what you mean. But look, if you think about the surface of a sphere, if that's where we lived as little two-dimensional beings on the surface of a sphere, in some sense, there are no straight lines, right? There are just circles that go around the sphere. But in another sense, you can do what we do in the real world to make a straight line, which is just keep walking in the same direction. There's even a technical term for that in relativity called the geodesic. The shortest distance between two points might not be straight, but it still exists, and you can still walk on it.
What about the idea that everything is vibration in this universe, so you can't have a zero point in time because everything is moving?
You know, it depends, once again, on what level of description you want to go down to. You know, at the fundamental level, we don't even know if space and time exist. So it is absolutely possible that the idea of a straight line just doesn't apply at the level of quantum mechanics and gravity playing together. But that's a regime in which we know so little that I'm not going to make any grandiose claims about it.
Sean, one of the things you do in your book that helps me wrap my head around our physical universe and the things we understand it does and the things we still question about why it does what it does are using thought experiments. And one of my favorite thought experiments from your book is the spherical cow philosophy. As you point out, it doesn't work in dairy farming, but it can be very helpful in physics.
It's an old joke that physicists like to tell only amongst themselves because no one else thinks it's funny. But the dairy farmer wants to improve dairy production, milk production, and they go to the local university and drop by the physics department, which is already a mistake. I don't know what they were thinking, but they say, how do I improve my milk production? And the physicist comes back and says, okay, first, I've solved your problem. Assume a spherical cow. And the idea is that physicists really think like this. They oversimplify the world. They say, like, well, these objects would fall at the same speed if you neglect air resistance and friction and things like that. But the miracle is, in physics, it works. In dairy farming, maybe it wouldn't. Maybe the fact that cows are not spherical is important. And in flying an airplane, the fact that there's air resistance is kind of important. But physics makes enormous progress by simplifying things and boiling them down to their essences and then adding in the complications later. So that's an important methodological insight into why physics is so successful.
And another example you give in your book, and we don't have to go too far into it, but it's just a ball on a hill as a thought experiment and how that directly applies to particle and quantum physics. And it gives you this idea that, you know, once you begin the process of trying to understand our world and what we don't understand about our world, is that these ideas are graspable. They are understandable. We can comprehend this, can't we?
I hope so. I mean, that's certainly, I did write a book and I'm hoping everyone in the world buys it. So I do hope so. The idea that I had was that when we teach physics students, we imagine that they're going to be in university for at least 4 years. If they're going to be professors, they'll be in graduate school for another 5, 6 years, etc. So we have their attention for literally years of physics courses, and we can go slowly, build everything up, teach them to solve equations, etc. And I think that too often, when we try to talk to the rest of the world, we say, you know, oh, well, you're not a professional physics student, so I just can't tell you all the good stuff. But we can, and I sort of want to sneak some of the good stuff in there, not just in poetic metaphorical language, but in the precise way the physicists would talk about it. And it helps you draw connections between things in the universe that you never thought of drawing before.
1-800-642-1234 to join us while we still have some time left. Bruce in Cumberland, you're on the air with Sean Carroll.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of the things I found most profound about physics was motion in two directions. And the previous caller had mentioned that everything's vibration. And that didn't really play into my equation when I'm thinking about when I throw a ball, it takes this particular arc until it hits the ground. But it doesn't really travel in an arc because the world is spinning. We're rotating around the sun. Our solar system's moving. Our galaxy's swirling. It's moving within its galaxy cluster. And so it really doesn't take that straight arc. It kind of does some really wild stuff when you boil down what it really is doing.
That sounds like the theory of relativity from Bruce, Sean.
You know, it is wild stuff. I'm going to have to agree with the caller here. There are no perfectly straight trajectories in nature because everything exerts an influence on everything else. And that makes things complicated. And it goes exactly back to the spherical cow question. Because if you insisted on explaining and talking about the universe exactly and without any approximation, it would be hopeless. There's just too many things going on and everything is affecting everything else. But we can make very pronounced progress by simplifying, by making the universe a little bit simpler than it really is, by ignoring the fact that everything is acting on everything else and just looking at a couple of important things one at a time. So thank goodness for that feature that nature lets us do that and make some progress in thinking about it.
Why is this important, Sean? Not just to physicists, but to people who are walking out there in our physical world. Why do you think physics is still important for people to learn?
Well, I think it's up to them. I'm not forcing anyone to learn physics if they're not interested.
Okay.
But I think that most people are deep down. They want to know what happened at the Big Bang. They want to know what a black hole is. They want to know why it takes energy to drive a car. They want to know why you can mix things but not unmix them. If you just let them, give them permission to ask these questions and learn about what we have learned about them, what we have discovered, and also what we don't yet know, I think it helps dissolve some of that anxiety that they built up by struggling to get a B+ on their physics exam.
Sean Carroll, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon with some of the biggest ideas in the universe.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Professor of Natural Philosophy at Johns Hopkins University, joining us to talk about his book coming of the same name, The Biggest Ideas in the Universe. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Rick Essenberg from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty explains their lawsuit to block the president's student debt relief, and a constitutional scholar will be along to explain the ramifications of that case. Join us for that, and as well, tomorrow is also Food Friday with a special. We recreate some of your favorite restaurant dishes tomorrow with copycat recipes courtesy of Taste of Home magazine's James Shend and his readers. If you have some restaurant secrets of your own, we will certainly hope you'll share tomorrow on Central Time.